my wonderful friends and everyday wellness community. Before we start our episode today, I wanted to tell you about an incredible opportunity. So many of you reached out, you love the podcast, you want to not have to listen to ads, and we now have the Everyday Wellness Insider Community that is ad-free. You get early access to podcasts. There's a monthly members-only newsletter where you're going to get content we don't share anywhere else, and you get priority access to programs, supplements, and so much more. And for the investment of a cup of fancy coffee once a month, you will go to www.cynthiathurlow.com/insiders. That's www.cynthiathurlow.com/insiders. This has been created because so many of you have reached out, and it'll allow you to take your listening pleasure to another level.
Welcome to Everyday Wellness Podcast. I'm your host, nurse practitioner, Cynthia Thurlow. This podcast is designed to educate, empower, and inspire you to achieve your health and wellness goals. My goal and intent is to provide you with the best content and conversations from leaders in the health and wellness industry each week and impact over a million lives.
This is the third episode in the Lipid Masterclass Forum. Today, I'm again joined by Dr. Thomas Dayspring, who is a fellow of both the American College of Physicians and the National Lipid Association, and is certified in internal medicine and clinical lipidology. Today, we continued our conversation about ways to look at other lipid abnormalities as they pertain to abnormal ApoBs, the lab values that we are striving for, the role of lifestyle modifications, my own lipid journey that I briefly touch on, including the medication I've been taking for the past 6 months, the role of diagnostics and the limitations, including discussions around CACS, coronary artery calcification scoring, CIMT, specific labs to look at, the role of LP little a, and the impact it has on our heart, including calcifying the aortic valves, changes with the loss of estrogen in menopause, clues to look for as a woman to predict future cardiovascular risk, including things like gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, miscarriages, preterm babies versus full-term babies, early or late start of menses, among many others, how estrogen helps clear LDL in the body, and the changes with menopause, including having higher ApoBs, risks in women specific to cardiovascular disease, the impact of the Women's Health Initiative study, as well as absorption and synthesis challenges with cholesterol. I know you will find this conversation incredibly interesting. This is a full hour-long episode really devoted to women's health and abnormal lipids. Again, this is the third in a series on the Lipid Masterclass with Dr. Dayspring. And so kind of getting back to the ApoB, especially for people, if they're listening, men or women, and they want to be their own best advocates, what are the lab values we're looking for? Someone who is metabolically healthy, no diabetes, no vascular disease, what number are we aiming for versus someone who has known vascular disease or diabetes?
Yes, that's crucial criteria there, because whatever ApoB or whatever level I'm going to recommend to you obviously depends on your baseline risk. If you're a total nightmare, if you come walking in with a scar on your chest or you've had three stents, I'm going to want to turn you into an infant again with an ApoB at 30. But if that's not you and you're just a middle age, a woman going through menopausal transition, you don't have coronary artery disease that you know of, and at a certain point, we actually start screening for that nowadays too, with non-invasive imaging that is available to us, but a poor tool earlier in life, because what you see in an older person might not be there in a younger person. So you got to be careful who you're doing imaging on. So somebody comes in and Obviously, they don't know what a cardiologist is. They've never been admitted to the CCU or the bypass unit. They don't have xanthelasma in their eyelids or sticking out of their elbows, which are cholesterol collections suggesting a serious genetic cause. For whatever reason, they had a lipid profile. They probably even didn't do ApoB. But if you listen to us today, you know the things in a lipid panel that ought to jump out at you and make you think you need an ApoB is total cholesterol being high. It's LDL cholesterol and ApoB particle. It primarily drives total cholesterol. If you calculate VLDL cholesterol and that's high, you know you have a triglyceride problem, which always translates to an ApoB problem. So a triglyceride above 70, as Cynthia said, ought to make you think I want an ApoB before I say I don't worry about a trig of 110. And of course, LDL cholesterol, if it's beyond a certain level, and I would tell you that level ought to be 70 milligrams. The guidelines would tell you 100, but I would tell you 70. If your ApoB is, your LDL cholesterol is 76, I think you ought to be doing an ApoB level. And of course, the HDL cholesterol, the only way that might, if it's low, you absolutely need an ApoB level. But we're actually finding now the old mantra that the higher your HDL cholesterol, the better is true in some people and not true in others. And women tend to have higher HDL cholesterol than men for reasons we're probably going to explain. But if a woman comes to me and says, my doctor did the lipid panel, and yes, my LDL-C is high, and there's some other bad stuff here, but my HDL-C was 150, so I don't have to worry about anything. My head starts to explode because we know I introduced to you there are people who have dysfunctional HDLs. They don't do the good stuff they're supposed to. And in some people, overloaded HDL particles full of cholesterol, devoid of ApoE, which we don't think are not good HDLs. So that would be a person that you'd worry about. So how would you solve it? I do an ApoB. I can't solve the H, but if the ApoB is high, I can take care of that. So there's one other test we didn't talk about, and I know at some point we will. It's an inherited lipoprotein disorder called lipoprotein little a. It's an LDL particle that attached to the ApoB is another usurper protein called apoprotein little a, small case a. It's a nightmare atherosclerotic lipoprotein. One out of five Americans has inherited it, one out of three Blacks, one out of three Asian Americans. So that has to be part of your initial screening. So the person I'm going to give you ApoB now has also had an LP little a test, and it's negative. Because we would want a lower ApoB if I knew you had high LP little a. So you come in, your lipid numbers maybe are a little out of whack, but they don't cross. They're not red on your lipid panel that comes back from the lab. But if you've listened to us today, you know, all right, I went out and got the ApoB. Here's my ApoB. Now what do I worry about? So here's how we look at this. And I'll send to Cynthia, I don't know if she does slide notes, but I'll give you a nice chart that shows all this that'll be there for everybody to see. At what point do the ApoB particles have the potential to start crossing your artery wall? We make this judgment if we take regular populations, and theoretically they're healthy, and we're excluding the people with coronary artery disease, at what and we look at what we call population percentiles. So you could have the lowest levels in the world and you'd be down at the fifth percentile. That means only 5% of people would have a better reading than you. 95% would have a worse reading. We could look at the 90th percentile and say, oh my God, you're worse than 90% of the people in the world. Not good. We could look at the 50th percentile where you would say, well, half are worse than me, but half are better. Trust me, with ApoB, you don't want to live at the 50th percentile because that's Russian roulette. Some will get bad, some won't. So we normally, with lipid concentrations, like to see the lipid parameter that you're looking at under you being the bottom 20th percentile. That's usually, and if you could stay there, your chances of maybe some ApoB particles will get in over time, but not enough to give you serious atherosclerosis, unless there's other things going on, high blood pressure, you're a smoker, blah, 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 blah. We're talking about healthy people here who don't have those issues. If you really wanted to have a phenomenal ApoB, there is a set of people that, for whatever reason, they either catabolize their ApoB particles or they don't make many. They wind up with very low ApoB or LDL cholesterol levels. It's called hypobeta lipoproteinemia. And if you study them genetically through Mendelian randomization studies, or if you even follow some of these people over time, they have extremely low incidence of atherosclerosis, if not no atherosclerosis. So that's defined pretty much as an APO, an LDL cholesterol under 40 to 50, and ApoB under 40 to 50. So if I could snap my fingers and give everybody in the world an ApoB of 40 or 50, I would. But in most people, you just can't get there without pharmacologic therapy. I don't want to put the world on statins or any other lipid problem right now to make them hypobetas. I just want to maybe get them to the 20th percentile. And I'll follow them over time. And if it stays there and they don't start smoking or their BP doesn't go out of whack and their menopausal transition isn't too nightmarish to screw up the lipids and lipoproteins, you'd be happy with that. You can start looking at other diseases that are going to impair either health span or, God forbid, longevity. And that's why I say with the women, I like the whole body. I look at it. But even in men, there's a lot of parts in men's brains are sometimes important too. So we all have to look at that. And, you know, they have certain things below the belt that you want to keep working also. So there are many things to figure out. And both genders get cancer, so you have to start screening appropriately for that. So if I wanted everybody's ApoB to be in the 20th percentile, it's really 80 milligrams per deciliter would be fine. But if I really wanted you at the 5th percentile, which is a little bit of a hypobeta, but it's close, and that would be a level of 60. I think in most healthy people, that's pretty much overkill, unless you're reading some longevity book and they know that these hypobetas just don't. So make yourself hypobeta. But that's probably, if you're otherwise leading a healthy life, going to require drugs to drop an ApoB that high. So if your ApoB is 80, you're at the 20th percentile. If it's above that, that's the time where you bring in somebody who's schooled in nutrition and in lifestyle, and they start going over you with proper exercise programs, proper eating programs, and then you can keep your ApoB 80. And if it's 90, just doing those things is probably going to make it 80, where I don't have to take out the prescription pad. Even at a certain point where, you know, your lifestyle didn't do it, there might be some, not many, but supplemental recommendations I could make that at least might reduce the absorption of cholesterol into the body, which should help ApoB a little bit. So you should know about those. And ultimately, if your ApoB is not budging because you did the great lifestyle, or it's at a really, you come to me with an ApoB of 120, unless you're a total pig out nutritionally, you might need a drug. And a lot depends on your age and how much willing you're willing to cooperate with the lifestyle and everything. And if you're insulin resistant, lifestyle works like magic, that's for sure. So at a certain point, you're going to need a drug, but you don't need a drug day one if you're otherwise healthy and your ApoB is even a little scary. Look, even if it was in the 80th percentile, which I'm thinking ultimately I'm going to need a drug, I would like to give you the time to show lifestyle. How low can you get it with lifestyle? Maybe I need less drug, or I don't need two or three drugs to get you to goal. So I never, never want to downplay lifestyle. You know, I have a gigantic Twitter following, and people assault me. Oh, you're just a drug pusher. No, you got to realize I'm a lipidologist. I see the nightmares of the world. So, and in general, they need drugs. But I think people need appropriate advice with pharmacological care. And they sure as hell need appropriate lifestyle, whatever you want to call it, nutritional and exercise, mental health advice, review. Perhaps you're taking other medications for other serious conditions. Some of them can putz with lipids. So I have to know a lot about you. So it's a complicated decision, but early on, it's the population we're talking about now, it's not drugs. Yes, if you come in with a crack in your sternum or three stents, if you're not already on drugs, you've been going to an incompetent, so I'll be put you on. But even if you went to the surgeon, or sometimes they're a little not as aggressive with ApoB as they should be for people with coronary disease. So I'm probably going to give you further pharmacologic advice, but that's for the nightmare population.
Today's podcast is sponsored by NutriSense. It combines cutting-edge technology and human expertise so you can see how your body responds to different types of nutrition, stress, exercise, sleep, and where you are in your menstrual cycle in real time. And by pairing a continuous glucose monitor with their app and expert nutritional guidance, NutriSense can help you reach your health goals. And the best part is it's not just a program where they send you the CGM and you have to figure it out on your own. Each subscription plan includes 1 month of free expert nutritionist support. Your nutritionist will work with you one-on-one, interpreting your data and providing customized advice to help you reach your health goals. The last time I had my CGM on, my registered dietitian and I troubleshooted over some specific concerns that I had. And whether you're aiming to lose weight, stabilize your energy, or just feel better overall, NutriSense offers the guidance and support you need. And lasting sustainable change takes time and can be achieved through a longer-term subscription. That's why I encourage my patients and clients to consider 3, 6, or 12-month subscriptions where it's actually less expensive and allows you to not only achieve your goals, but also to ensure that you stick to your healthy lifestyle for the long term. As I've mentioned before, I have found the CGMs I've used through NutriSense to be incredibly insightful, specifically to carbohydrate tolerance. I would not have known that plantains spiked my blood sugar without this information. It's also been hugely helpful for tailoring to workouts and sleep quality. And so for me, even though I am metabolically healthy, I find the insights to be particularly helpful to tailor my lifestyle changes to my blood sugar. Visit NutriSense.io/EWP and use the code EWP for $30 off plus 1 month of free nutritionist support. Be sure to let them know you're a listener of the Everyday Wellness podcast when they ask you how you heard about them. This is one of my favorite ways to take care of my health and one of my top recommendations for all of my patients and clients. Consuming Element on a daily basis is one of my favorite ways to take care of my health. And we know that by consuming proper amounts of electrolytes, it can contribute to quality sleep, which is critical to all of my perimenopause and menopausal patients and clients. We know that magnesium increases a neurotransmitter called GABA that is known for producing calming effects. And consuming adequate levels of sodium can help you sleep through the night because low sodium levels increase cortisol and adrenaline. Additionally, if you are intermittent fasting, it's important to understand that when you fast, two things can dehydrate you. Number one, if your insulin levels remain low, it can signal to our kidneys to excrete more sodium or salt, a process called naturesis. And as glycogen or stored glucose is broken down, the water left over from the glycogen breakdown is urinated out. So if you want to take care of your health in one of my favorite ways, you can consume Element electrolytes. My favorite flavors are grapefruit and citrus, but there are many others to choose from. And if you go to drinkelement.com/Cynthia, you can get a free sample pack to try them out on your own. Again, it's drinkelement.com/Cynthia for your free sample pack where you can try all of their flavors. No, I think this is so important because you're really stressing how important lifestyle is, number one. Number two, you can get a patient to a certain point and then considering pharmacotherapy is completely appropriate. And for full disclosure to my listeners, I don't think I've talked about it on the podcast. There's a genetic predisposition. I am insulin sensitive. I exercise. I sleep well. I'm on HRT. I do all the right things. And I still required medication because, and thankfully you're sitting as I say this, my ApoB was 130. This is absolutely a genetically mediated piece. Yeah. I just had labs drawn last week. So we're going to see the net impact. I'm on a drug called Zetia. It's an expensive. We very strongly believe that I'm a hyperabsorber, which contributes that, but we'll see where the numbers are. But I've been on that for several months now. Now, if someone comes to you, let's say hypothetically, their ApoB is high, you want to screen them. The screening tests that you've been talking about, I'm sure you're talking about a CAC, so a coronary artery calcification, and maybe looking at the specialized carotid artery scans. Are you doing stress testing? Is it really dependent on if someone's symptomatic or asymptomatic? What are the next steps? Because I'm sure for you, it's, you know, looking a little deeper to figure out what else may be at play.
Look, it's a complex evaluation. This is not something in 30 seconds I can tell you everything you need to know. Chances are we will need a additional diagnostic studies for sure. Talk about stress testing. Look, if you have an asymptomatic person, unless they tell you I'm going to climb Mount Everest next month or something, okay, you want to see what their exercise capacity, maybe you don't want a VO2 max for a fancy stress test, but just a plain stress test looking for EKG changes. You have to have serious coronary disease for them to show up. Hey, a nuclear stress test will pick up, but it's a lot of radiation with a nuclear stress test. So I'm not a big advocate of those for asymptomatic people. Nowadays, we do have the coronary calcium, which is a cheap test looking for calcium deposits, radio opaque in your coronary arteries. Not that expensive, widely available, but it's not good in the younger years unless you have FH, who you expect heart disease when they're 16 years old. You, a healthy person coming in at 20, 30, even premenopausal, coronary calcium is, you know, if you come back with a zero, nice, but that doesn't mean anything. You still could have a lot. The carotid imaging is certainly the type of imaging you can use in a younger person, but a big caveat. You need to go to somebody who's well-schooled with carotid intimal thickening analyses. Half of the practices that have them in their office, they don't know what they're doing, so you get idiotic readings out, and you're going to make some serious decisions based on these. I think you've got to go someplace that really knows what they're doing with carotid intimal. So again, you got to do your homework to see where you're going. There are vascular tests, flow-mediated dilation, and other ways where they put blood pressure cuffs on. But not everybody is doing them. Again, you have to go to a trusted practice that is well experienced with them and has a long history of doing them. They can all give you early clues that your arterial bed is not what it should be or so. So that's it. You pretty much, I divide this nowadays. I have a nice slide. When you're born, those kids we talked about, their ApoB level is normal. And for most kids throughout infancy and even early adolescence, their ApoB is normal. That's called primordial prevention. Yeah, you'll do the oddball lipid test. They don't need them every year at that age. But you don't see an abnormality, you're not going to do anything unless the kid is overweight or blah, 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 in which case those tests would probably be abnormal. So, but at a certain point, the ApoB starts to cross those thresholds I talked to. But they haven't had coronary disease yet. You probably wouldn't find it. I mean, if you autopsied the kid, you'd find fatty streaks in the aorta. We first found that out in the early studies where kids were getting hit by cars or run over by trains. And at 8 years old, they had fatty streaks in their aorta. And we knew atherogenesis occurs very early in some people. So once the ApoB is high, I call that primary prevention. I got to work on you through lifestyle or whatever to get you back to the primordial prevention levels. And that's usually pretty amenable to lifestyle, unless you're like Cynthia, you've picked the wrong mom and dads and you got some bad genes at play. And look, lifestyle, we never want to dismiss it even in her. You can look at her and see she's doing lifestyle things well, but she's still reporting a terrible ApoB. So of course, keep doing all the things to your healthy lifestyle, but here's what else you need. So you would use, but once, say, Cynthia, if we did say that coronary calcium on her, or even a fancier test called a CTA, computed tomography angiography, they're not sticking catheters up in your heart and injecting dye into the arteries. That's like pre-bypass stuff. But we would see not only calcium in her arteries, we would see, oh my God, there are some luminal irregularities or even plaque within the wall of the artery. And that's what I call secondary prevention. She hasn't had a heart. In the old days, secondary prevention meant you had a heart attack or stroke. No longer. Secondary prevention means we've diagnosed atherosclerosis using invasive or non-invasive imaging procedures. So then we know you're a hell of a lot closer to a rupture that I talked about. Once the rupture occurs or the luminal occlusion occurs, that's tertiary prevention. If you survive that, we still can prevent the next one with super aggressive therapy, but you're probably looking at three drugs in those cases. So these are some of the diagnostic tests you need to weigh. But other than the lipid panel, other than just relying on, geez, my trigs is a little high, I do think you need others at a certain level, other tests of insulin resistance or so. So whether that's going to be a fasting insulin level, if you do that nuclear magnetic resonance testing, the lipoprofile I mentioned, you will start to see certain lipoprotein signatures of insulin resistance. Your LDLs will be small, your VLDLs will be big because they're packed full of trigs, your HDLs will be small because they're being rapidly catabolized because they inherited triglycerides, and actually make, based on about six lipoprotein characteristics, something called an LPIR, lipoprotein insulin resistance score. Zero is you have no insulin resistance. 100 is if you're not a diabetic yet, you will be next week. And so obviously you want a level well below 50 on there. As you start to approach 50 or going higher, long before even your glucose might go up, we know you have the type of insulin resistance we're very worried about. Super opportune time to get in there and start doing lifestyle. Apart from lipid drugs, you know, the world is full of all these magical fat disappearing drugs nowadays that people sometimes are jumping on a little too soon before lifestyle, but they're out there now, even fraudulent ones that somebody's making in their basement. So God forbid you had to go to a GLP-1 receptor. That I think a prescription product would be smarter to use. They're in short supply and your third-party coverage may not be so good. So, but there are insulin resistance is a whole nother animal that, yeah, you're probably going to need some lipid control, but you're going to need a lot of other stuff, insulin sensitivity control, and you're probably borderline hypertensive there too. So that's going to have to be addressed. So you can see how we start with the basic lipid profile and where we might just, all right, we got the ApoB. What we do about it depends upon coexisting things. And if you did test for that LP little a, everybody right now needs it once in their life, earlier rather than later. If that was out of whack right now, all we can really do is I want to take your lowering of ApoB to the next level. I surely want it under 60 if you have a high LP little a. In the future, we may have drugs that address LP little a production. They're in development. They have to pass rigorous testing and safety testing. So we'll see when and if they come to the market. Not now.
Yeah, it's really interesting. As I, you know, was preparing for our discussion today, one of the things that stood out about LP little a that I did not actually know is that it actually can invade our aortic valve. So this is one of the valves in the heart and can contribute to calcific aortic stenosis, which for anyone that's listening and saying, what does that mean? This is quite significant. I saw a lot of patients, especially older patients that had aortic valve disease that ended up going on to need to have their valves replaced and or repaired, but this can be quite significant. And so this is why the screening tool for the LP little a is so important, because if you know at 25 or 30 that you've got an abnormal LP little a, you can be doing things then and not waiting until you're, you know, diagnosed with a disease or valvular heart disease or a calcific aortic valve, because that's quite significant.
It certainly is. And so if we discover high LP little a, we're certainly worried about your atherosclerotic future. But especially if you get early in life, somebody better be watching that aortic valve closely. You know, in the old days, I'd put a stethoscope on your chest and I'd hear a systolic murmur. That's almost too late. Nowadays, we have echocardiograms. And I think periodically, anybody with high LP little a needs an echocardiogram here and there. And Cynthia knows better than I. There are other dynamics that come with the echocardiogram that can give you a lot of things about how good is your aortic valve working. In my day, we were told, oh, every aortic valve, it's just they were born with a bicuspid valve, meaning they had two leaflets instead of three. And now we're knowing, yes, that's still a big problem, but LP little a is rapidly coming up as the number two or number one or number two cause of aortic stenosis. And the big characteristic of it, it's calcified. ApO little a has a lot of bad properties, but it's sort of osteogenic. So it makes white blood cells turn into osteoblasts in your damn aortic valve. And, you know, it's not good to have cement in your aortic valve or bone. Not good. Because the aortic valve, for those listening, is the main valve that blood flows through when it goes from the heart into your aorta and elsewhere. And you can't have that narrowed because over time, the muscle pumping, it gets destroyed. You cannot wait till heart failure because then it almost doesn't matter what you do. And fortunately, we have so many better ways of assessing early heart function nowadays. And the people who know what they're doing, jumping in much sooner with aortic valve, which can be done through your chest wall. They often don't even have to crack your sternum, which is good. And so, but if you know you have LP little a, anybody's got a family history, yeah, there was a lot of aortic valve in my family. Good God, get your LP little a tested.
And the big takeaway for the LP little a, unlike some of these other tests, is that it's a one-time test. Like I've actually set up my teenagers and my husband to have it checked. And I said, if you're all within normal limits, great. But if you're not, then we know we need to do more than what we're doing.
One more point on that. When you go through menopause, and ultimately we will discuss this, loss of estrogen causes an increase in ApoA, a little a protein production. So If a woman, whatever her LP little A was pre-menopause, it's going to go up a little bit after menopause. And most women, the normal LP little A is still normal, but it's just a little higher. But if you happen to be a serious LP little A, it's going to go up. I mean, it was serious before. It's even a little bit more serious. So that's the one time it can change. You're starting this, never test it during an infection. It's an acute phase protein that your liver produces inappropriately, because it probably wants your blood to clot when you're in a disaster. But if you're in stable shape, the only time we may have to start repeating it is if any of these drugs that lower it work, they may show us if you're a nightmare, here's how much you have to lower it. In those cases in the future, we will almost surely be repeating LP little A. Right now, we're not. I don't know if ultimately we'll get into some of the lipid drugs we're using. There is one available now that can lower LP little A a little bit. So maybe if you're on that drug, following LP little A would be of interest. So.
Now, we talked a little bit about women in menopause, but in preparation for our discussion, I had heard you on another podcast talking about risk factors for women, things or clues. So if you're a woman who's not gone through menopause, clues about your medical history, and this is specific to pregnancy history, PCOS, et cetera, that can clue you in that you are probably at higher risk for complications, lipid issues, et cetera. And this I found really interesting because this is obviously not my area of expertise, but understanding that your age of pregnancy, any complications with your pregnancy. So if you think preeclampsia is not something that's a long-term issue, it can be. Same thing with gestational diabetes. Can you speak to that? Because I'm sure there are listeners that are impacted and may be completely unaware of this issue.
Sure. So if I was seeing a new patient who knew they were approaching the menopause, or even if she's in her early 40s or whatever, even if she's not, I would ask very specific questions to at least me to think, I think you are in early menopause, even though perhaps you haven't recognized it yet. Obviously, there are certain symptoms that it's a no-brainer that something's going on. But the first thing, if you see a middle-aged woman, when you start doing your initial comprehensive history, you have to spend a lot of time on the pregnancy. First of all, yes, at what age did your periods even begin when you were a teenager or so? Your menarche, early, late, that's important information. Then you would want to know, were you ever pregnant? Well, no. Well, did you have any miscarriages? That counts as a pregnancy too. If so, how many? So you want to know the gravidapparita abortio ratio, because if, spontaneous abortions do portend future cardiovascular risk. If they were successful pregnancies, you say, okay, any prediabetes during the pregnancy, any hypertension of pregnancy that they had to address. Nobody ever found protein in your urine, did they, when you were pregnant? I know they probably never checked it, but would you happen to know what a triglyceride level was in the second or third trimester? All clues that will portend future cardiovascular risk. If I delivered and the son or daughter was fine, what was the baby's weight? Was it a premature delivery? Did they have to induce it, or what, did it go to full term? By the way, once Junior or Junior S was born, did you lactate or did you not? Very important as far as both for the child and the mom as far as future cardiovascular risk. Now, if she answered yes to any of those and her others that I haven't even elucidated, there are very available women's guidelines with the checklist of things you have to go down, which if you check them, potential future vascular issues here. So, and this is so important even for obstetricians to know this stuff nowadays, because they're the ones delivering these kids. The internist is usually not getting involved at that stage of the game, and unless the woman was a diabetic during pregnancy or something. But presuming she wasn't, the obstetrician should know, listen, I'm done. I've developed Junior. You know what to do now. You got a pediatrician for the kid. But we did see these little bitty risk factors for you. You were a little preeclamp. I think you did have subtle hypertension, your glucose, any of those that were present. That woman, I mean, I'm looking at her as, uh-oh, future cardiac, big time trouble. And that just means that you don't say to that woman who may have had the kid at age 22, when you hit menopause, go see your internist because they'll work you up. You go see your internist soon, and that internist will do some baseline things in you. That internist will be aware of these things that happen during pregnancy, and that internist will follow your cardiometabolic risk factors extremely closely. And probably long before you get to menopause transition, you're going to need further lifestyle or even pharmacologic advice. Waiting to 40 or 50, average age of menopause is like 51. That's way too damn late for any woman, because you've given up decades of possible preventative care in that woman. And look, if you're telling a woman to come in, she can drag her husband along once a year too for a lipid profile or a cardiovascular risk assessment, because the men are actually, depending on how ugly their metabolic panel is, do get heart attacks sooner in life than the women. So maybe there is something about this estrogen story that we have to get into, and why when estrogen goes bye-bye at menopause, other issues may evolve. A quickie. One of the regulators of that LDL receptor that clear the ApoB particles out of plasma is estrogen. So women lose estrogen at menopause, all of a sudden their LDL receptors aren't as many as they used, or they don't live as long as they used to. So her ApoB clearance goes up a little bit and ApoB starts to rise. The man never had damn estrogen to begin with, so his ApoB, his LDL receptors are at probably an unhealthy level sooner than they would be in a woman. So that's one way you relate hormones to atherosclerosis.
At some point, we've all been sold a big fat lie. It's called the protein misconception. So starting in the 1980s, we all believed that more protein equated to more muscle growth. And I'm here to tell you, it's a big misconception. This has a great deal to do that our body can only absorb protein that's broken down into smaller building blocks called amino acids. It doesn't matter if you're consuming 30 grams of protein or 300 grams of protein. If you don't have a sufficient supply of enzymes to digest the protein, your muscles will ultimately be unable to use these as vital building blocks. That's why it's crucial you take a high quality digestive enzyme. The one I trust and use myself is called MassZymes by Bioptimizers. MassZymes is a full spectrum enzyme formula with more protease than any other commercially available product, with five different forms of protease. Plus, it contains all the other key enzymes you need for optimal digestion. If you're experiencing bloating, gas, or digestive distress, a contributing factor can be that your body is no longer producing as much digestive enzymes. And you can try MassZymes today, risk-free. They have a 365-day full money-back guarantee and is the gold standard in the industry. Go to bioptimizers.com/Cynthia. That's bioptimizers.com/Cynthia and use promo code Cynthia10 for 10% off of any order. Again, that's promo code Cynthia10 for 10% off any order.
A great deal about our focus on everyday wellness is on supporting gut health. And one of my new favorite ways to recommend to family and friends and even clients is to consider colostrum. And so Equip Foods has an amazing product that helps to improve immunity and gut health and recovery. And each scoop contains grass-fed, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free colostrum. And if you're wondering what colostrum is, it's a nutritional powerhouse that serves as the first source of nutrition for mammals in nature. It's been shown to enhance immune function, gut health, and recovery with vital nutrients such as lactoferrin, growth factors, and prolon-rich polypeptides. Colostrum is a natural milk-like fluid produced by mammals immediately following delivery of the newborn. And while colostrum is a dairy product, it does not contain milk or lactose. So most people with lactose intolerance usually find colostrum very easily digestible and beneficial to gut health. You can use one scoop a day. You can mix it in things like coffee or mix it in shakes or even yogurt, or even some of your baked food recipes. As I mentioned, has a lot of health benefits, including research demonstrating the improvement in a reduction in inflammation, promoting good gut flora and supporting restoring leaky gut to normal permeability. And what I love best is that Equipped Foods is very ethically focused. Their cows are humanely raised and ethically treated, and cows produce an excess of colostrum when nursing. So only after their babies get what they need are they able to source the excess colostrum for use in their products. There is 3 grams of colostrum in each scoop, and one serving in comparison to main competitors has just 1 gram. And research demonstrates that this dose of 3 grams actually promotes more benefits to gut health, immune function, recovery, and vitality. So if you'd love to take care of your health, you can go to www.equipfoods.com/Cynthia20 to get 20% off your first order. That's www.equipfoods.com/Cynthia20. You definitely want to check this out.
No, I find it all so fascinating. And it's interesting. I think a lot of women worry about breast cancer. And what we actually need to be more concerned about is cardiovascular disease, ASCVD. And you know, this is from a paper that I just read that it said 1 in 3.2 deaths in women a year. Heart disease is the number one killer, accounting for one death every 80 seconds. And HRT, so hormone replacement therapy, is a sex-specific primary preventative therapy for heart disease and all-cause mortality. So if you're not talking to your doctor, your NP, your PA about HRT, and you're in perimenopause or menopause, you should be, because more women are impacted by heart disease than they are breast cancer. I'm not saying breast cancer is not important to be concerned about. I'm just saying from a loving place, from someone who spent 16 years in cardiology, there were far more women who presented late. They present atypically. They put it off because they're worried about taking care of everyone else. And yet this is what's more than likely going to kill us.
I'm so full of jokes. When I graduated med school in 72, my postgraduate training in another 3 years, and then I went into private practice. So through med school and residency program, don't worry about women. The heart attacks are all the men who get them and stuff. And you know, I used to scratch my head because I loved hanging in the CCU. They were just being invented in my day, and it was like this: if you were smart, that's where you wanted to hang out because you had a chance to maybe save a few. But there were women in the CCU. What the hell are they telling me women can't get heart attacks? Now, some of them were smokers, yes, but still not all of them were. So women get heart attacks. And you see these stats where, yes, ASCVD is the biggest killer of women and men. And everybody thinks, yeah, it's our great-grandmothers who are dying of these heart attacks. Yeah, some of them, that's true. But if they actually lived that long, they're probably going to die of something. It's, you don't want to see the modern stats of even premenopausal women who are getting cardiac ischemic or obstructive atherosclerotic disease or non-ischemic coronary disease, which is a vasospastic issue that women. So you just get that out of your head that women don't get atherosclerosis. They do. And like everything else, guys and gals, the sooner we develop it. The estrogen story is so interesting. At the early part of my life, you were a jerk if you didn't start every woman on estrogen, including super high dose estrogen. In my early days, what's a progestin? We didn't even know about that. And so that started to evolve that, well, we certainly have to give progestins. And maybe at a certain point, we could lower the dose of estrogen. Because even with the oral contraceptives in those days, we were seeing strokes in young women because they drowned those young women. The first OCs, the estrogen doses were ridiculous. So that all got tempered out and rediscovered over time. But then it was, if you're a gynecologist, every woman was going to be put on hormone therapy as she approached menopause, no exceptions to the rule, unless there was a blatant contraindication, a lot factor five deficiency, blah, blah, blah. A little bit of breast cancer was started to emerge. Early on, there wasn't even that big a worry. So, and all of a sudden, these estrogen studies started to come out. The first was the HER study, where in John Hopkins, they actually took women with pretty serious coronary disease, and they gave them the most popular product used. It was Prempro at the time, conjugated equine estrogens and medroxyprogesterone acetate, on the belief that giving these women hormone therapy would erase their coronary artery disease. And of course, it didn't. It's actually a null study. Some women did have some adversity at the end. So, oh my God, you know, what's the newspapers? Estrogen is killing women. They don't tell you it was women with pretty serious heart disease, which would now pretty much be a contraindication to most hormonal therapies. So that was the first study that came out. But then ongoing was the Women's Health Initiative, which was a gigantic study. But some women who were perimenopausal, early menopausal, and a lot of them were late menopausal women, which we now know is probably not the woman you're going to start on. But these women either got a placebo or they got HRT. Again, Prempro. If they didn't have a uterus, they got just Premarin without the medroxyprogesterone. And lo and behold, as they started to crunch the numbers, before the paper even got published, it came out that, again, there might be a bad cardiac signal. But remember, you're looking at a diverse population of women, including grandmas, early menopausal, and not even yet menopausal women, but on their way. So it's tough to know if you're giving women to this diverse population. Was estrogen hurting one group and perhaps helping the other group? That didn't come out early on. But the newspapers, oh my God, it was all over TV. Stop estrogen, doctors, you're killing women. And, you know, it was MPA CEE, there was maybe a little breast cancer signal there. Nobody was looking at the intensity of that signal or what was the real risk, but the headlines were nightmarish. So HRT prescriptions were pretty high over a few years. Like even gynecologists were prescribing a lot less HRT. And you know why that was not good? Because as we now know, there are some women who can get nice benefit from appropriate types of hormone replacement therapy. And there are some women who should never get it, for God's sakes. We're a little smarter now. We always are. As blips come in medicine, we always react and do. And ultimately, it filters out. But it took a good 15 years of more post hoc analysis of these trials to see. So now the indication is pretty much perimenopausal, early menopause. Unless there's a reason not to use it, appropriate menopausal hormone therapy, if that's what you want to call it, is probably doing good. There always is a dilemma then, at what stage should I go on forever? Should I stop it? And that's not an easy decision to make. But again, if a 75-year-old woman is walking in, I'm probably not starting her. This even applies to not only heart disease, it applies to bone, where you really want to get estrogen in early. Yes, we have other osteoporotic therapies, but in my day, it was the bisphosphonates. We drowned women with them, and it took us 5-10 years to find out, oh my God, you're creating brittle bones in some women. You're killing too many damn osteoblasts. You don't want to kill it, or osteoclasts. You need osteoclasts for proper bone remodeling. So that was another lesson we had to learn. And then, of course, the anabolic drugs got developed, and we have so many more products nowadays, but that's a complex thing that has to be evaluated in a woman. Pelvic things is, I'm not going to put you per se on oral estrogen to help your vaginal wall or your prolapsed bladder or so. That's going to be localized estrogen therapy. So again, it's another whole, even no matter what, you're a woman who needs estrogen therapy. Is it unopposed? Is it opposed? If it's opposed, are you going to use progestogens? Is the natural progesterone plus a ton of synthetic products called progestins. So with estrogen, which progestogen do I want to recommend? And if I do recommend it, at what points in the cycle, or is it intermittent? It's very complex how to figure out. And even now, when it gets to the estrogen, there are not only are many different estrogen products. I prefer estradiol, which is what the ovary makes, but do I give it orally? Do I spray it? Do I rub it on her? Do I stick a high dose in her vaginal wall? So you can see, and how many do you believe? I will tell you, no internist going to residency is giving any education on the complexities. Gynecologists might be, I would hope so, but they're not giving any education on ApoB or how do I worry about the heart in a woman, or what woman would I not give estrogen because of the heart, you know? What about LP little A? And that's very controversial too. What should you give estrogen to that or not? So you can see we're right back to what Cynthia and I told you. how does a woman get good care nowadays? How do you find a physician that knows everything like that? So look, I think you got to go to the national, or it's now called the Menopause Society, not the North American. They would have people who are certified in that. Probably a good choice. Certainly, if you know you have an ApoB problem, or for sure an LP little a problem, you might want to look out somebody certified in lipid. And by the way, they're not all MDs. There are nurse practitioners, there are physician's assistants, there are osteopaths and a naturopaths. Some of them are osteopaths are really the same as an MD. But, you know, we all have different types of training and interests. At your stage of the game, you should know what your problems are and you got to find the right person. But you don't have to be an MD per se.
Yeah, no, I think you bring up so many good points. And, you know, I endeavor and my mission with this podcast is being able to deliver the best and the brightest in the healthcare and wellness space so that it can allow people to become more empowered and inspired. And I agree with you. I've been through multiple providers to find the person I'm with now that listens to me. He's a male. He's an MD. He listens to me. We make decisions together. He's very respectful of my needs. He also challenges me when he doesn't agree with an opinion I have. And so I think everyone deserves to have really good care. And to your point about HRT and finding out, you know, what mode of HRT does someone need? Not everyone in perimenopause and menopause needs the same things. You know, some people, you know, as an example, some people need progesterone just around their cycle in their luteal phase. I'm certainly a proponent of progesterone. I think that's made such a big difference in my sleep. But in terms of looking at other things that can contribute to abnormalities in lipids, I want to make sure before we end the conversation today, because obviously we'll have another one. I was jokingly telling Dr. Dayspring I had 8 pages front and back of prep, which says a lot because there's so many different directions to go down. But something that I thought was really interesting, and I've learned a lot listening to you and learning about your work, when we're talking about cholesterol abnormalities, things that are genetically mediated, you know, people can either be absorbing too much cholesterol, I'm going to oversimplify, or they can synthesize too much cholesterol. So before we end our conversation today, let's tie this in so that people are aware that, you know, the primary mechanism that may not be working optimally in their body could be, like it is for me, I have an absorption problem. I absorb too much cholesterol, and that drives a lot of the issues along with an abnormal ApoB. Let me be clear, but can we touch on that subject just to kind of tie up our conversation today? And obviously I'll bring you back because we have so many other things we could talk about, including medications and other labs that we can be looking at.
Yep. She's touching a topic dear to my heart. I'm prejudiced, but I think most lipidologists would tell you the best textbook in the world that deals with lipid therapy is called Therapeutic Lipidology. It's a thick hardcover book. First came out in issue 1, now issue 2 this year was produced. And if you get asked to write a chapter in that book, somebody thinks you know something about something in lipids. And in both of those books, I wrote the chapter on how the body handles sterols, specifically absorption and synthesis of sterols. And I've already told you, yes, it's cholesterol, but there are a lot of other sterols. And what do you have to know about them? So it's a topic so dear to my heart. I also worked in biomedical laboratories, super advanced cardiovascular, but for 7 years. And of course, they get into all the advanced type of clinical chemistry that you can do. But, and that's where I even added to my expertise in understanding absorption of sterols, because we were doing these type of tests that can be done on hundreds of thousands of people. And obviously, I had to study that and learn to it, talk to experts in the field about it. So I fell into menopausal medicine first, but then I dumped into the absorption synthesis. And how cool is it that actually I wrote the paper where we were the first one to discover menopausal women start hyperabsorbing cholesterol? Wow, it fit in perfectly. And we're going to need another podcast to really get into
yes.
the depths of cholesterol absorption and what could go wrong, either genetically or even in a menopausal woman to do that. But now with that aside, I just wanted to whet your appetite that it's such a crucial topic. Again, that most clinicians just have never been taught. So unless they're self-taught or going to reading my chapters in the book or going to CME courses, they're never going to learn it. We want to have normal ApoB. So if you have a high ApoB, we have to instruct your liver Either stop making ApoB particles or, God darn it, upregulate those LDL receptors that grab those ApoB particles and clear them. Because if the liver clears them, they get destroyed. And every ApoB particle you destroy is one less that can go in your artery wall. So the liver is the master controller of peripheral lipid control. Again, forget the brain. That's different. Your brain is not connected to the intestine with respect to steroids, although maybe with other things it is, as I'm learning in some of these microbiome discussions. But anyway, so I have to, if Cynthia comes to me with a high ApoB, two things. I have to try and find out why she has a high ApoB. And if I really discover that, I think I could probably make a much smarter treatment decision on how to lower ApoB in her. So it's what makes a liver stop making LDL receptors so it stops clearing ApoB LDL particles. One, the liver is either synthesizing too much cholesterol or it's not, but the intestine is absorbing too much cholesterol and the chylomicrons are grabbing it all and dumping it in the liver, overloading the liver with absorbed cholesterol. The liver, hey, look, cholesterol toxicity in the liver is one of the causes of fatty liver. So if the liver is getting a lot of intestinally delivered cholesterol, I'm not making LDL receptors. I sure as hell don't want to pull in LDLs carrying more cholesterol, so they don't manufacture. And there are what we call nuclear transcription factors in the liver that tell your genes what enzymes and what proteins and what receptors to make or not make. So if Cynthia has something wrong with her intestine, that it is overabsorbing cholesterol, she's drowning her liver in cholesterol, she's making less LDL receptors. So obviously, if I knew that ahead of time, I would say, Cynthia, I think we probably have to work on reducing the absorption of cholesterol in you. Number one, I want to have a little discussion with you so you understand this is not a simple process. It's regulated by a few things. And once you understand that, then either the lifestyle or pharmacologic therapies, and some of them may be an intestinal supplement, you're going to be much more prepared to say, you know, you make a good point and I'll try it and see. Ultimately, the bottom line is going to be, if we addressed absorption, did our ApoB go down? Because there are other things affecting those LDL receptors apart from synthesis and absorption that could be, if she inherited a goofy gene that's affecting her LDL receptors, and you throw hyperabsorption on top of that, that's why you approach pretty scary ApoB levels. So who knows? But at least the initial therapy in her would be, let's reduce absorption. She did mention she's taking a pill, ezetimibe is the generic. The brand name is Zetia, but the generic is much more affordable. It's a simple one-a-day pill with very few side effects. We can include you in on them, but they're like next to nothing. And you would significantly reduce the amount of cholesterol her intestines, because it screws up that receptor that is pulling in cholesterol, deactivates it in part. So you're going to absorb less cholesterol. Your chylos are going to deliver less cholesterol to the liver. All of a sudden, the liver needs cholesterol to make bile acids, so it will upregulate more LDL receptors and clear more ApoB particles. And that is exactly how ezetimibe reduces ApoB. There will be a little bit less production when the liver makes VLDLs and LDLs. There'll be less cholesterol going into them. So it's also working on this ApoB particle synthesis route, but also the clearance. And clearance is the primary way of getting rid of those. And it's just so fascinating, because that receptor that pulls cholesterol from your gut lumen into the intestine, which makes it way to your liver has that same receptor that sits at the hepatobiliary interface, where the liver interacts with your biliary system, which is how bile acids and cholesterol get to the gut. But that receptor can also pull cholesterol back out of your bile into the darn liver. Oh, no. But the same drug, Zetia, that blocks the receptor in the gut also blocks it at the hepatic. So most people don't know Zetia. Ezetimibe works in two crucial interfaces to reduce the amount of cholesterol getting into your body. So that's the short man's absorption story.
If you love this podcast episode, please leave a rating and review, subscribe, and tell a friend.